My name is Gene Cochran. I'm president of the Duke Endowment, which is a foundation based in Charlotte, North Carolina. I find it helpful to make the caveat that we are the Duke Endowment. We're not Duke University. We're not Doris Duke Foundation. We're not Duke Power Company. There are a lot of Dukes spread around, but they are all interrelated by family. As one family generated an awful lot of wealth in the early part of the 20th century. But in my case, he set up a foundation in 1925 with four very distinct and specific grant areas, one of which was healthcare for us to work in North Carolina and South Carolina. And so for those years since 1925, we've been focusing largely on hospitals and the delivery of healthcare in those two southern states. And that has led our organization through investments in things like the creation of Blue Cross insurance services in both of the Carolinas, through Hill Burton of building a lot of hospitals in the 60s and 70s of closing down some of those hospitals, watching some of them move to being for-profit institutions, many of them moving from for-profit now back to being not-for-profit again. Healthcare has waxed and waned, as you know in your communities and certainly as we know in ours. And as a foundation, and as you, with your giving programs, what the trick for us has been, especially as the national conversation has moved towards what is a national health program, is trying to find that route that we can navigate through everything that we hear, all the conversations that we hear, all the proposals that are out and moving around as to what will happen or won't happen or what's possible or what's not possible. And for philanthropy, trying to make sense out of what a foundation, what a family giving program, what an individual donor does in that environment. And for us, our particular decision was to look at it and say, well, regardless of what happens on a national scene, what do the Carolinas need and how do we respond to that? And that's led us into discussions with state leaders in both of our states, with other activities of focus of health workforce, because we don't have enough providers even after all these years of working. What do we do with rural areas? What do we do with information technology? And hope for the best with what comes out of Washington with national health plans. So as a funder, as you, I am particularly pleased to introduce and to moderate a panel today, and I was thrilled when the Philanthropy Roundtable asked me to do this, because to my left are three experts that have very different perspectives on where we are today, as we say, as how philanthropy responds to healthcare in the United States at this point. First, I'll introduce everyone first and then ask them just to proceed on with their comments. We're going to start with John Goodman first. John is president of the National Center for Policy Analysis. The center does a lot of very interesting and very good and very detailed work in Washington about issues that face our country and our society, one of which is healthcare. And John will speak to that, particularly about the paying for it and who's covered, who's not covered. Then secondly, following John, will be Grace Marie Turney. Grace Marie is president of the Galen Institution, and that is a think tank consulting group that works specifically and I think almost exclusively in healthcare. So we'll go from a broader focus into a more specific focus in our discussions. And then lastly, Melissa Stevens, who's director of strategic initiatives for Faster Cares, which helps us understand how philanthropy can work with donors that have particular interest in diseases or treatments or whatever that technology might be, and how they can all be linked together to make the healthcare systems we have and the treatment systems that we have more effective. So lastly, the three of them will speak, and we will open it for conversations and questions among each of you. I'm thrilled that we've got a group of this size because I think it's going to lend itself to a good conversation after a few minutes. And you will see us experimenting. If you're here for the opening session yesterday, you heard the comment about these chairs are really soft. Trust me, they are. I'm going to take one home for our den because these things are really comfortable. But we're also pretty low, so we're going to experiment with standing and seated. But please, interact. Tell us if you cannot hear, if you cannot see, if the line of sights are not well, and we will adjust accordingly. So, John, let me turn to you for opening our comments, please.
Thank you, Gene.
You know, in a very real sense, the public policy debate is shifting to the blogosphere. And as a matter of fact, it's the blogs that are about the only place where you find left and right really engaged in serious policy debates with each other. If you Google the John Goodman Health Policy blog, you're going to discover two things. First of all, it's about the only right-of-center health policy blog on the Internet. I wish there were more of them, but there's just not much there. By right-of-center, all I mean is that our blog, we have people who believe that economic incentives matter. And we believe the reason we have so many problems in healthcare is because people face perverse economic incentives. If you want to correct the problems, you have to correct those incentives. Certainly, this is the place where pro-free enterprise ideas are vetted by people on the right and the left, and it's not just conservatives, it's across the spectrum and high-level people at both ends. The second thing you're going to find is that this is the only blog of any political persuasion that has a sense of humor. I don't know what it is about health policy, but it just, you know, attracts, you know, people with no sense of humor at all. And not only do they not have a sense of humor, they don't even know when I'm joking a lot of times. And this has got me in trouble with people like Paul Krugman at the New York Times, who I think, John Fun, you'll agree, has no sense of humor. Yes, anti-humor. So what we had to do is we created this little yellow yield sign, which is a warning to the humor challenge that you know, it says satire alert. So when you see those passages, you're not supposed to take them completely seriously. But we do things like we had a post the other day about how Obamacare is going to push you into HMOs and they're going to ration your care. And then we'd have Ethel Merman underneath that singing, "Say a Little Prayer for You." And then we had a post on end-of-life care. And underneath that, we had Bob Dylan singing "Knocking on Heaven's Door." And then we had this real, real heated exchange between the doctors and the insurance companies. And this one doctor wrote in and said, you know, "You insurance companies, you're killing our patients with your rules." And so underneath that, we had Leslie Gore singing, you know, "You'd Cry Too If It Happened to You." And sometimes we're accused of being insensitive and irreverent. Probably the worst thing we did, there was this man in Dallas who went down to the Parkland Memorial hospital emergency room. He waited 19 hours and he died before he ever saw a doctor. And it was a real tragedy, and we thought this could happen in other cities as well, so we posted about it. But underneath that, we had Lionel Richie from YouTube singing "All Night Long," and that's probably the most insensitive thing we've done. What's about to happen in a little over 2 years is we're going to have a huge rationing problem in our healthcare system, and you're already seeing signs of it, but it's going to get really, really bad in a little over 2 years. The estimates are that Obamacare will insure about 32 million new people, and if the economic studies are correct, these people will try to consume twice as much health care as they're currently consuming. And then in one of the really strange things in this bill, it's going to force everybody else, including everybody who's above average income, to have more coverage than you really want. And there's a whole long list of preventive services, mammograms, pap smears, and so forth, that you're going to get with no copayment or no deductible. And then once you have all this coverage, you're probably going to take advantage of it. So what I'm describing is a really big increase in demand, especially for primary care, and no change at all in supply, because there's nothing in the bill that creates any new doctors or any new paramedical personnel. So big increase in demand, no change in supply. That means a rationing problem. That means waiting lines start to grow everywhere at every doctor's office, especially primary care doctors at the emergency rooms. This is exactly what happened in Massachusetts. I remember Governor Romney telling me back in the early days, you know, once we get this bill underway, people won't have to go to the emergency room for expensive care. They'll go to the doctor's office for less expensive care. But I don't know where he thought the new doctors were going to come from, because they weren't created in the Massachusetts health reform. And so today you see in Massachusetts more people going to the emergency room than ever before, more people going to community health centers. The same kind of rationing problem we're going to have nationwide. We're predicting, you know, 1 million new emergency room visits, and it may be much, much higher than that. Now, what happens in this kind of world? How many of you, any of you have a concierge doctor? Anybody in the room? Anybody know some other people who have one? Okay, a lot of you. Okay, all right. Well, this is where it's going to go, because you're probably not going to want to wait as long as you're going to have to wait for the services that you want. And what the concierge doctor offers you is a way not to wait. And in most places, it's about $1,500. And for this fee, the doctor talks to you on the telephone, emails you, keeps your records electronically, prescribes electronically, is your agent in the healthcare system, helps you get the MRI scan,
deal with a specialist. Some of them, if you actually had to go to an emergency room, will go meet you there so you don't wait the 19 hours. Now, the problem with the concierge doctor is that when they leave their normal practice, they were seeing 2,500 patients. They go over and become a concierge doctor. Now they've only got 500 patients. So that means the 2,000 they left behind have a worse problem than you had before. So the more doctors that leave, the worse the rationing problem gets. And in this kind of system, you do not want to be in a health plan that pays below market. And by below market, I mean less than what other plans are paying. Well, who's going to be in these plans? Well, if you're on Medicare, you're in a plan that pays below market. So that's the elderly and the disabled. If you're in Medicaid, poor people are in a plan that pays well below what others are paying. If Massachusetts is the guide in the new health insurance exchange, those plans are going to pay just a little bit better than Medicaid, so they will all be at a disadvantage. So what I'm really describing here is the most vulnerable people in our society, and irony of ironies, I'm sure if you asked the Democrats way back when, what do you think you're going to do with this bill, they probably thought they're going to provide more health care to vulnerable populations. In fact, what is likely here is that access to care is going to go down for the vulnerable populations, not up. And you know, a sort of a window on what's about to happen was created by the New York Times when they surveyed the dermatologists a couple months ago. And what they discovered is if you're a Medicare patient and you come to the dermatologist for just a sort of a normal skin problem that Medicare covers, you call and you get voicemail. It's several weeks before you ever get to see the doctor. When you get there, you have sort of a Spartan waiting room where you wait for your care. On the other hand, if you call in for Botox, which of course you're paying with your own money, you get a live person on the telephone. You get that day or the next day in to see the doctor. You get a much nicer waiting room. So what we're talking about is a two-tier system that's emerging all over the country. Just for dermatological procedures. We're going to see this, I think everywhere. Now, what is not well understood about our healthcare system, both on the right and on the left, I mean, the conservatives are just as wrong about this as the liberals, there's a tendency to think that we have basically a capitalist system. And up in Canada, they have basically a socialist system. And mea culpa, you know, I contributed to this. I think our book, Lives at Risk, is probably still the best book on international healthcare systems. But after I wrote it, I realized, you know, I made a mistake. I emphasized too much how we're different from Canada, when in fact we're about 85% the same. And the fact of the matter is, in Canada, if you want to see a doctor, it's free. In the United States, when you see a doctor, it's almost free. Every time we see a physician and spend a dollar, only 10 cents is coming out of our own pocket. The other 90 cents is paid for by an employer, insurance company, or government. The main way we pay for health care in this country is the same way the Canadians pay for it. We pay with time and not with money. The most important barriers to care in this country are not price. See, all over Europe they think that poor people get priced out of the market here. No, that's not it at all. It's non-price rationing that is the biggest obstacle we face, just as it is in Canada and in England and all over Europe. What does non-price rationing mean? It means how long does it take you on the telephone to actually get an appointment with a doctor? And once you get somebody on the telephone, how many days, weeks do you have to wait before you actually get in to see the doctor? And then how long does it take to get from your home to the doctor's office and back? And once you're there, how long do you have to wait in his waiting room before you see him? Those are all the non-price barriers to care. There's lots and lots of evidence that that matters a lot more than money. There's a fascinating study that came out just the other day that came to this fascinating conclusion. We're in the worst recession in our lifetimes. And did you know that unmet health care needs have gone down? There are fewer unmet health care needs now in the middle of this recession than they were before it was started. And the apparent reason is that people who have health insurance are now becoming more careful buyers of care. They're price shopping. They're putting off unessential care. And as they do that, they free up resources on the supply side. And now with the resources freed, a lot of the uninsured people find it easier to get in and get their needs met. Price hasn't changed at all. It's the non-price barriers that came down, and that's what makes care more accessible. So for the middle class population, it's pretty clear that it's not price, it's non-price barriers that are standing between them and care. But it's also true for poor people. In North Carolina, the state was trying to save money on Medicaid. And so it said for a prescription, you know, they were getting 90 days at a pop. And they said, you can't get 90 days, you can only have 30 days at a time. So instead of making one trip to the pharmacy, now they had to make three. essentially tripling the time price of care. And at the same time, they said, well, it used to cost you a dollar for this, now we're going to charge you $3. So they tripled the money price of the prescription. And then they discovered that the tripling of the time price made a much bigger difference in compliance than a tripling of the money price. So even for poor people, it's the non-price barriers which are the larger barriers. If you want to know why it is that on healthcare conservatives usually don't have much to say, nor do Republicans, and when you begin to talk to them, you discover there's not much difference in the way Republicans and Democrats and conservatives and liberals think about all this, is because none of them understand what we're now talking about right here. Everything we're doing to get healthcare to poor people is the wrong thing. The whole philosophy behind Obamacare and most of our programs for low-income people is let's make price as low as possible, not understanding that that's not the real barrier. We'd be better if people could pay money at, say, a minute clinic or walk-in clinic and avoid the wait, and then you'd get care, cheaper care, better care available to more people. So we, bottom line is, we're going to have a big rationing problem. It's going to hit our most vulnerable populations the hardest. And we're approaching the whole thing the wrong way right now.
John, thank you very much. Grace Marie?
Is it easier if you, for you all if I am at eye level so I could walk around too? But I just, maybe this is, we're close enough that you all can see me and you're sort of spaced around. So thank you, Gene, for your introduction. John, always for really talking about the important big picture. And Melissa, we look forward to talking with you about the important research, which actually gives physicians something to use to treat patients with. I want to talk a little first, sort of 30,000 feet, where we are, and then I want to talk a little bit about where philanthropic entrepreneurialism can still really make a difference, I think, in the health sector. There really wasn't any disagreement, I think, about the goals of health reform. Cover more people. We need to make sure we're not leaving people out in this society. And make sure that healthcare is more affordable. Those were really the two goals. And from so many perspectives, this legislation is failing. And I think it's disappointed a lot of people. It's disappointed people who's worked so hard to support passage of this legislation. There's a new Kaiser poll out, a sort of left of center organization out just this morning that shows that 51% of Americans now oppose the healthcare law and only 34% support it. So, and that's a pretty big jump in the opposition to this law. And there really are a lot of reasons for that. When the law was first passed, even in the most optimistic projections, it's going to leave 23 million people without health insurance. People thought, we're going to get to universal coverage, right? We spend $1 trillion, surely we can cover everybody. No, at least 23 million people uninsured, according to the Congressional Budget Office. Is it going to lower costs? No, we've already seen costs go up almost double just this year, just because of the early provisions in this law. Free preventive care, covering 26-year-olds. Those are good ideas, but they cost money. We see this week the CLASS Act, one of the two new entitlement programs in the law, the long-term care insurance program. The administration says we can't make this work. They told us that we have to make this solvent for 75 years, and we can't figure out how to do that without an individual mandate, which they don't have for this part of the program. And then you have 26 states in one suit, two other states in their own suits, fighting this in federal court. The Supreme Court is likely to make a decision in its November 10th meeting about whether or not to take this up this year. So you have the states resisting implementation of the law. So cost, access, physicians, 40% of physicians are seriously considering leaving practice by January 1, or certainly cutting back on their patients in public programs as soon as this law kicks in, because they don't want to practice under all the rules and regulations. So we have failed in really trying to accomplish what we wanted to do with this legislation. And either politically, legislatively, just the implementation of it, or through the courts, it's going to fail. So what do we do? When Hillary Care died in 1994, Republicans just sort of said, done, we're done with health care. And look what happened. They can't do that again. We have a very narrow window to be able to come up with a solution that will work to show the American people, okay, this law is not going to work. We still have serious problems in our health sector that we need to fix. And what are you going to do about it? Maybe we can talk in the Q&A, because we just sort of have limited time here in the beginning. That's a whole other talk about what we could do. But there are ways to really make markets work, to put doctors and patients back in charge of decision, to make the health sector work more like the rest of the economy. And what we have instead is a law. Have you all seen this? Interesting. I have a couple of copies. Let me send this one around over here. This is a depiction that the Joint Economic Committee, the staff of the Joint Economic Committee, trying to figure out how does this law work. And each one of these sections is a new power, the 159 new boards and commissions in this law. Each one of the lines here shows a particular section in the law that allows the authority for this new spending. Patients. Doctors over here. I mean, the center of the universe is Secretary Sebelius. And this is just not the way this economy works. This command and control centralized, they can't figure it out. And the CLASS Act is sort of the first, I've got a few more copies in the back after this, and I'd be happy to give them to you. But this is really just the first example that the law doesn't work. It's really working against society. So what are we going to do? I was talking with John Fund last night. John Fund doesn't take many bets. The Wall Street Journal, you know, John. He's taken 69 bets in his life. He's betting that the law, the individual mandate, is going to be declared unconstitutional. And he doesn't lose bets. So, John, you're looking for the person to...
I put my reputation on the line.
So we've got to figure out what we're going to do instead, and that's what the policy community does. I mean, work with John and work with a number of other people. We run a group called the Health Policy Consensus Group to really pull people together around market-based ideas. We have those ideas. We need to make sure the American people understand now this isn't the right answer. We've got to make the health sector work more like the rest of the economy. I was doing some research for this talk and found that in 1920, private philanthropy supported healthcare 90% as much as of the spending in government. Private philanthropy paid 90% of all the health spending. And to the federal government's 100%, private philanthropy 90%. John, you could probably say that better than I can. But they, today, any guesses? 0.4% private philanthropy. And still private philanthropy is spending $817 million a year on healthcare projects. It just shows that this huge, massive explosion of government spending is really what is now so dominant. And just like with education reform, I think that there are opportunities with private philanthropy to really show the right way. We don't have a healthcare system in this country. We have a sickness system. They only get, doctors and hospitals only get paid if somebody's sick. And I can't tell you how many times I've talked with CFOs of hospitals and other board members who say that they had to discontinue programs that were reaching out to the community, keeping people out of the hospital because the CFO were saying, well, but that's revenue we lose. We can't support that program. So those kinds of programs, I think, that save taxpayer money, that save that money so it's available for other public spending that hospitals can't support because it affects their bottom line. And we have to look at some of the assets that we have. There are 5.3 billion mobile phones in the world today. There are 7 billion people. So almost everybody knows somebody who has access to a cell phone. And that is a huge opportunity for outreach. There's a program called Text for Baby. One of the hardest things is to get teenage moms to come in for their prenatal visits because I'm healthy, I'm fine, I don't need to see a doctor. So what they're doing is providing cell phones to these moms so they can text messages, you know, did you take your vitamins today? Time for your appointment, come in and keep nagging them if they don't do it. Medicare can't pay for the cell phone, and Medicaid can't pay for the cell phones, but they certainly can pay for the doctor's visit when they come in. So there are opportunities to reach out to people for things that the public programs can't pay for and that hospitals are unwilling to pay for through private philanthropy. There's another really cool program that sort of using technology, I hadn't heard about this, something called Glow Caps. You know, one of the most important things in healthcare is for people to take their meds. And so you put this little device on the top of a pill bottle, and it lights up and makes little sounds when it's time to take your pills. And if you don't take it off, if you don't do it, then it calls you, sends you a text message. And if you don't do that, you could program it to call a friend, to call a neighbor, call a parent, to call you and say, did you take your meds? I mean, that's a simple little thing, but medical compliance is so important. And those little tools can make that happen. There's also, we all hear about technology being, you know, that's really the driver of healthcare costs, right? And we wonder, well, why doesn't the same thing happen in the health sector that happens in other sectors in which the cost of technology goes down? Well, it can. General Electric is a big maker of ultrasound equipment. If you're a big teaching hospital in New York, you're going to spend $100,000 for the, you know, all the bells and whistles. Well, they said, we can actually make that a lot cheaper. And they made one for $10,000 for rural clinics. And somebody said, well, you know, we really need one cheaper than that for third world countries. So they now have a handheld ultrasound machine that costs $3,000. So technology, if we really push it, can make things cheaper, but the system is organized against that. And then there still are a lot of really wonderful, committed physicians giving their time. There's a clinic in New Jersey, in Somerset, New Jersey, anybody from New Jersey, called Zarephath, started by John and Alita Eck. They're both physicians, in conjunction with their church to provide free care. Doctors doing what they want to do, take care of patients. There's a little box and people come in. If you can pay something, please do. And a lot of people do for the dignity of being able to provide care. They see patients for an average of about $13 a patient. They keep people out of hospitals and emergency rooms that could cost several thousand dollars for a visit. They provide free medicines, but they can only be open 12 hours a week because they have to actually run their practices and see people. So there are things like that. And there was one story where they worked with the church to help a family that had 2 autistic children at the point that the parents really had a hard time going to church. And so they said, well, we'll put together a program where we'll take care of your children while you're in church so the parents could go to church together. The father is an air conditioning maintenance person, so he said, if you'll do that, I'll take care of the AC and heating system for the clinic. So those kinds of things, I think, really are still very prevalent. Local is really good. There's another final example, Illumination Foundation in Los Angeles, that was looking at homeless people that have been hospitalized. And they can't be discharged because they don't have anywhere to go. And so they put together, they bought a little small motel, and made, turned it into a recuperation center so that Medicare, Medicaid patients could be discharged rather than just being, using the hospital bed sort of as a recovery place, to really be able to go to a place where they could get nursing care and really help them get back on their feet, sometimes literally, and into society. And this is, again, a private foundation. Instead, Medicaid patients have hospital stays that are twice as long as other patients, often because they don't have anywhere to go. They said, we can do that. We can provide a place to go. $175 a day instead of $2,300 a day under Medicaid. So there are huge opportunities for private philanthropy to, I think, show the healthcare system the right way to do this, to really work toward the values and the goals of the charitable nature and the inclusive nature of the society. We don't want to do what John said, is leave people out. We're going to have 87 million people on Medicaid once this law is fully in effect at the end of this year. The system can't handle that. And a lot of people in this subsidized insurance are going to find that they can't find a physician at all because those new state plans are going to pay at Medicaid rates. We have to solve this for a lot of reasons. We have a very short window. If we don't come up with better ideas that the American people understand and embrace, then this law is going to go into effect. And I am very concerned about what this means for freedom and for the what really is the finest healthcare system in the world. Thank you all.
Chris Marie, thank you very much. So you see my earlier point about we started with a broad perspective and moving into a more focus on healthcare and specifically what philanthropy can do to deal with some of the opportunities that might be there. So let's move to a slightly altered approach, but yet still again, very much focused on philanthropy and philanthropy's role in how we might respond to the health situations and the health opportunities that we have to now. Melissa, let me turn to you.
Sure, great. Well, I'm pleased to be here with all of you today and my fellow panelists, especially at a Can-Do Philanthropy event. And I undoubtedly work for a Can-Do Philanthropist, and that is Mr. Michael Milken, who has been named the man who changed medicine. And Mike founded Faster Cures in 2003. We are a think tank and a catalyst for action in Washington, D.C. We work across diseases and across sectors to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of the medical research system so that we can better develop treatments and get them to patients faster. But it's almost impossible to talk about Faster Cures without telling a little bit of his story. So Mike was diagnosed with prostate cancer in 1993, and he was given 12 to 18 months to live. I can tell you he is a vibrant, doing very well, and actively involved with all of our events. He certainly beat the odds. But as a can-do person, he came to Washington. He met with the National Institutes of Health, the National Cancer Institute. He met with industry. He met with academia and said, who's in charge of my cure for prostate cancer? And he realized no one was. People were studying the disease. No one was fighting the disease. And so he started the Prostate Cancer Foundation and really has carved some new ground in terms of how a patient organization and a nonprofit can change the way research is being done and really accelerate that process. And I'll get back to that model in a minute. But in parallel to that, he realized that regardless of the disease that you have, regardless of what sort of research you're working on, the system is plagued with challenges. And so we started Faster Cures to really sit at the nexus of all of these different players and really take this systems approach view. So we work with academia, government, industry, investors, philanthropists, and we try to figure out how can we make this process more efficient. So just to give you some context, it takes 15 years and costs $1.3 billion to bring a new drug to the market. It doesn't have to be that way. And those figures are escalating. In 1979, it cost only $100 million to bring a new drug to the market. In 1996, the FDA approved 53 new molecular entities, so 53 new drugs made it through the process and were approved. That number dropped to just over 20 last year. So the timeline is elongating, costs are going up, and the productivity is falling off dramatically. So it's really a time where we need to make some changes in the way that we do research. So faster cures, we look at this entire system and we really try to figure out what are the levers of change that we can pull that will improve the efficiency. So we work on promoting innovative cross-sector collaborations so that academia is working together with industry and nonprofits. We're really breaking down the silos that had previously existed in that system. We work at putting the patients at the center of the research process, since they know what they need, what they want, how much risk they're willing to take, and really making use of best use of patient data. So we're all our own Rosetta Stones. We all have genomic data that tells us about the susceptibility to disease. We have clinical data that's gathered when we go in to see our doctors. So how can we harness all of that to help us ask and answer better scientific questions? We also work in the areas of research policy, so looking at how the NIH in the $30 billion that it has to deploy to mostly basic science research, how can they best make use of those dollars? We are looking at the FDA and how we can improve the approval process on the back end so it's more predictable, it's more efficient, and it's not a hindrance to innovation. And finally, we look at how to best deploy capital. And we look at that from both a philanthropic perspective and a for-profit perspective. So for philanthropists who are interested in making a difference, we help to look across the disease and figure out what are those scientific questions that haven't been answered. Where can capital best be deployed to really advance research all the way from discovery through translational science into more of applied science and clinical trials. So that's where Faster Cures sits. And when we're thinking about opportunities for philanthropy to make a difference, I want to go back to sort of the Prostate Cancer Foundation model. And we've seen a growth of a number of innovative nonprofit groups. These are not your grandfather's nonprofits. These are organizations that have been started by patients, led by patients, and they are focused only on a new treatment. So these are groups like the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research, the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation. So these are groups that are really changing the way research is done, and they're really helping to decrease those costs and that timeline that I spoke about. And they're doing that in a number of different ways. So again, back to how they're deploying their capital. We have the NIH that is investing in very early stage basic science, really understanding biology. We have the pharmaceutical companies that are fund late stage clinical trials, but they're getting more and more conservative. They want to buy or license a technology that has good data that says, it's probably going to make it to the market. They don't want to be in early stage that's still really high risk. But that's the perfect opportunity for these nonprofit groups that are funded by philanthropic dollars to play a role. They are de-riskers. So they can fund this translational space where there's not capital now. And they can de-risk research to a point where it's attractive for a venture capitalist to come in or a biotech or a pharma company. Some of these groups are funding industry directly. So, for example, the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, they've put over $1 billion into drug development since they were founded in 1953. They work with Vertex Pharmaceuticals, Gilead, PTC Therapeutics. These are nonprofit dollars put to work to create research programs inside industry that wouldn't otherwise exist. And because of that, they now have a portfolio of 30 different candidates for in late stage development. So great success story. These organizations can also organize patients because they're connected to them. They have patient registries. They can quickly enroll patients into clinical trials. The Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation, for example, has a network of 16 clinical sites with a patient registry. They can enroll patients 30 to 40% faster than industry can. And that means real dollars when we're thinking about medical research. There's other ways in which these groups are really innovative. they are just in the way that they've re-engineered their administrative processes. So, for example, when you apply for funding from these groups, they require a 5-page application, and they can cut checks within 2 months. You juxtapose that to the National Institutes of Health, and you could find out 6-9 months. And if you print out all the paper that's required, you would have 6 feet of paper for an application for an R01 grant from the NIH. So these organizations are nimble. They can put dollars to work very quickly. So I think, you know, that is the biggest opportunity for philanthropists to have an impact in medical research and to really develop new technologies. And so there's a few areas where health reform intersects with those nonprofit groups. And first is around some changes at the NIH. In the health reform bill, there was the Cures Acceleration Act, which was put forward by Senator Spector, and that essentially creates a venture capital type of funding mechanism at the NIH. And so it really gives them an opportunity to fund in riskier areas of research, make larger sorts of investments. And so I think that's going to be an opportunity where patient groups are going to need to, you know, help to provide input as to how those dollars can be used, and also be responsive with their own budgets to make sure that they're being complementary to the changes in that funding mechanism. That goes hand in hand with the development of a new center at the NIH, which is the National Center for Advancing Translational Science, or NCATS as it's called, which really puts dollars and resources behind this translational research space. And there's great opportunity for patient groups and nonprofits to really plug into this mechanism. So for example, on the Bethesda campus in the NIH, they have a chemical genomics lab. They have a library of various molecules. They have robots that can do high throughput screening. And in May, there was a collaboration that was announced between the NIH, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, and the University of Kansas to take advantage of the infrastructure that they had there to look at how they could repurpose some existing drugs that could be applicable for leukemia. And so they're actually working with the NIH to look at some arthritis medicines and see if they could work for leukemia. So these changes in the basic science are, you know, funding mechanism and infrastructure is going to create new opportunities for patient groups. I think we also want to look at health information technology. That is going to be, you know, key to implementing health reform. In the stimulus package, the High Tech Act, incentives were created for the implementation of electronic medical records and health information technology. You know, what these patient groups now need to do, and what Faster Cures is doing as well, is to bang the drum as we're building that architecture, we need to make sure that there are capabilities for clinical research built into that. It's not just about improving quality and reducing cost. It is a missed opportunity if we do not use those electronic medical records to match patients to trials and to learn learn from the patterns of the data that we're seeing there to ask more profound scientific questions and to really advance our knowledge of disease. So then the last point I would say is around comparative effectiveness research. So health reform created the PCORI, the Patient-Centered Outcome Research Institute, that will head up comparative effectiveness research. So, you know, when we buy a car or a cell phone, we have all the information at our fingertips about, you know, what might be best for us. We don't have that with regards to different treatments, and PCORI will help to do that. But again, patients are going to be critical to providing their input about, what works for them, what is meaningful to a patient population. And many of these groups are activated in that sort of way. I know that the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, for example, they have worked with the FDA when they've heard that a treatment may not be approved, and said, you know, I know it's only 30% improvement for lung function. Do you know what that means to a cystic fibrosis patient? So these organizations really need to be engaged and activated and really, you know, use their patient vocal cords to communicate their interests. So I think I'll close there. So those are some of the intersection points with health reform. But aside from that, I think there are, you know, a host of really innovative venture philanthropy. We call them entrepreneurs for cures that are redesigning the way research is done and really helping to accelerate the development of medical solutions.
I hope you can all understand why I had such a great breakfast this morning as we were talking about what we might say. A few opening questions. Melissa, let me start with you after you have a sip of water. Mm-hmm. How does a philanthropist find you? And how do they connect with your organization?
Sure. So, you know, I think the, you know, how they've a number of ways of how they can find us, but I think one of the, we work with philanthropists through our growing network, through our founders' network. We host various platforms where we can help to connect philanthropists with nonprofits. We have an event, just for example, coming up in 2 weeks. It's called Partnering for Cures. It's built off of an investor conference model, which helps to we call it speed dating. You can kind of organize private one-on-one meetings. And so it brings all the different sectors of medical research together, but philanthropists and nonprofits are certainly there. So if there's someone who has an interest in Alzheimer's, the Alzheimer's Association, Cure Alzheimer's Fund, American Health Assistance Foundation, you know, a number of these groups will be there, so you can really start to understand not only at a 30,000 foot level what are the issues with medical research, but you can do private meetings with a number of groups to start to get some more information about their operations. We also help to do disease landscaping and to really understand, okay, this is where the science is, these are the major roadblocks. This is where pharma is not investing and NIH isn't investing. This is sort of the white space. This is where philanthropic dollars can really make a difference. So we provide a number of different opportunities for philanthropists to engage with others and to really have the information that they need to make really strategic investment decisions.
Very good. Krishna Murray, you mentioned the Supreme Court, and you also mentioned the window of opportunity that if the direction we're heading right now changes, that there's a window there that's there. Who's likely to lead that? I mean, you referenced the Health Policy Consensus Group. Is that a group? Is it a broader group? What happens 2 years from now?
The Health Policy Consensus Group really is just a loose affiliation of think tanks like the National Center for Policy Analysis, the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, and a number of center-left groups as well, working together to put together sort of the core ideas around health reform. And there actually is a pretty significant effort to actually do modeling to really come up with a specific plan. One would hope that one or several of the presidential candidates might find that this, in a way of articulating a much more specific idea, would adopt that. Candidates at all levels. It just the whole way the policy process works is putting ideas out there and helping people to really begin to see that that's the right direction. We actually, several of my colleagues and I did a book, so you know what was to come, Why Obamacare is Wrong for America. Maybe it's right for someplace else, but it's not right for America. My colleague Jim Capretta from the Ethics and Public Policy Center, Tom Miller from AEI, Bob Moffat from Heritage, and I wrote a book, and we actually have a chapter in here on what we should do instead. And we talk about a lot of the data, why this law is not going to work, and what we should do instead. But it's really around, and it's ideas we've been talking about since for 20 years. We've got to get doctors and patients back in the center of decisions and allow the market to work more properly, just like we learned it can with the General Electric ultrasound. And in order to do that, we've got to have some policy changes. And in order to do that, you've got to get the attention of politicians. I think we have their attention. If this law is repealed, or even if just the individual mandate, which is really the center pole of the tent, that everybody has to buy health insurance, it just can't stand. And so starting next summer, because the decision, if the Supreme Court takes this up, would likely have a decision by June of next year. Pretty soon after, people are going to say, okay, what's your idea? And I think we'll have an opportunity for a different conversation.
Good. And John, lastly, I was struck with your comment about your blog, and I suspect everyone here that's not signed up for it wrote it down so they can. There were conversations in our meetings yesterday about the importance of discourse. What advice do you have for the people in this room about how do you stay connected with the debate? How do you stay connected with the discussion about where we are and what's going and alternatives that are there?
First, let me just say about the blog, if you give me an email address, what you're going to get from me is a health alert. And I send one out on Monday and Wednesday, and then that takes you back to the blog. And then what you're going to find at the blog is, especially on those health alerts, we get lots and lots of comments of people arguing back and forth. And it won't just be conservatives. There's Uwe Reinhardt, who's the sort of leading liberal at Princeton, is often commenting there. The head of the physicians for National Health Insurance, something like that, he's there every day. So you're going to see a real interchange. The thing I like about the blogosphere is it's a place where left and right really do engage each other. And if you don't, then they'll just ignore you. What happens in Washington is people just put out press releases. They talk past each other. They don't have real conversations. And what I like about the blog is it really is a debate. It really is engagement. I think I'm interested in substance. And what's missing, particularly on the Republican conservative side of this, is a refusal to focus on the substance of the problems. There is a Republican plan. It's Senator Coburn. Tom Coburn had a bill in the Senate. Ryan is a co-sponsor in the House. It would take all the subsidies, all the taxes, and all the spending subsidies we now have, give every individual and every family a refundable tax credit, same for everybody. And it's a very good approach, much better than the Obama approach, but more radical than the Obama approach and more progressive than the Obama approach. What's missing, if you're interested in safety net institutions, what's missing from that proposal is if you offer people a tax credit and they turn you down, then you don't want to just dump that money back in the treasury. You want to make it available to the safety net institution where the individual lives. So that if everybody in Dallas decides, okay, we don't want your tax credit, we're going to be uninsured, then all the unclaimed credits go to Dallas safety net institutions. But if they all decide they want insurance, then you take the money out of the safety net institutions and put it into private insurance. So money follows people. I don't know if I'm a fair
answer to you. Absolutely. Yeah. Please join me in thanking these three very special people.